Hello and welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guest is Lolly Winston, author of Good Grief. Lolly was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and received an MFA in creative writing from Sarah Lawrence College. While in her 20s, she went to Hawaii for 8 days and stayed for over 8 years. Oh, her work has been published in New Woman, Red Book, Glamour, Working Mother, Family Circle, the San Jose Mercury News, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Sun, among other publications. She's taught at University of California Santa Cruz Extension, lives in Northern California with her husband, where she's at work on her second novel, Happiness Sold Separately. Today we'll be discussing Good Grief. Hi, Lolly.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
Great to have you on the line. What a wonderful book. I loved Good Grief, and I really, it's one of the few books I've read in recent months that, or years perhaps, that I didn't want to end. And or that I was hoping there was a sequel that I could go and buy right away, and which is odd in a way, because when you think about reading a novel having to do with loss and grieving, you imagine that you're in for some depressing times. Your tone is so light with the whole topic and just beautiful writing. Talk about how this book came about.
Well, I should say I'm not a widow. When I was in my late 20s, my dad died of cancer, and about 4 years later, my mother died of a brain tumor. And after my mother's death, I really struggled after my dad's death, and after my mother's death, I had a hard time going right back to work. I had a fairly new, high-powered corporate PR job, and I just wasn't pulling it together enough to perform well in this job, and I just started to come apart at the seams. And I had a writing teacher who said, if something's preventing you from writing, write about that thing. And I thought, well, you know, I think I'll start writing about grief and depression. And I had sort of a corporate meltdown similar to Sophie's in the book. In the book, Sophie shows up at work in her bathrobe and bunny slippers. That didn't happen to me. But I did have to quit my job, and I started working from home as a freelancer, and that's when I started writing Good Grief.
Interesting. How much did you know about the book before you started? When did the characters come in? When did, you know, the situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I knew the only thing I knew from the beginning is that I wanted to write a story about a woman who had a depressive breakdown brought on by grief. And I could imagine all of that. But that's a very internal journey, so I had to create characters for her to come in conflict with, and a story and a journey for her to go on, an external journey in addition to that internal journey of grappling with grief and getting at least somewhat better. I don't think we ever completely recover from a loss like that, but she does get somewhat better by the end of the book. So I sort of added plot and characters as once I got Sophie's character and her voice down, I began to add other plot elements and characters to the story. Hmm.
The book is told in first person, present tense. Talk about making that decision. Was it always written in that point of view, and what made you decide that that's what you were going to go with? It's a hard thing to pull off, and you have successfully pulled it off. It's beautiful.
Well, thanks. I know first person present tense can be limiting, and there are moments in writing where you feel limited, and you know you pound your fists on your desk, and you want more freedom. I guess that's the thing about writing from the third person. You have a bit more freedom, and the present tense is a bit limiting too. But I found that the present tense was helpful in that I could write about her present situation and then put everything. The story opens and her husband has been dead for 3 months. And so I could put their marriage and his cancer and his death in the past tense and so that I didn't have to do past and past perfect, but present and past tense. So I found a comfort zone with that, and I just found that the voice had much was much clearer and had much more immediacy as soon as it was in first person. I started out in third person, sort of limited point of view, and then when I switched to first person, that seemed to really punch up the voice for me.
Yeah, that it's real interesting, and I wonder too if the interior sort of quality of the book had anything to do with that. So much of, I mean, there's a lot of plot, there is action, but we are privy to so much of what she's going through, which especially works well in first person present tense.
Right, a lot of what she's thinking along the way, she feels like a crazy person, like she's losing her mind, and that's an internal journey, and she's not able to say a lot of what she thinks. So a lot of scenes and situations that she's in, I think, you know, you hear what other people say to her and you see what's going on, and then you're allowed. I think the good thing about first person and third person limited is that it allows you to be inside the character's head and see the world through their eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. How did the food aspect enter in as well? She ends up, well, I don't want to say too much here, but
she has a corporate meltdown and starts over and ends up discovering that she loves baking. And really, I chose that as a second profession for her because I was a former failed waitress, and as an English major, when I first got out of college, it was a hard time to find a job. So my first job was a breakfast cook at the Sheraton, and then the chef taught me how to bake all the desserts, so I became the baker. And it was from experience I could draw upon that. And, of course, I don't like to write about somebody being a writer, and I didn't have a lot of other experience, so I just decided that she would be a baker. And I knew a woman in Silicon Valley who gave up her high-powered corporate life to start her own business making savory cheesecake. So I decided that would be something for Sophie to do.
Mm. Will you read to us?
Pardon? Sure.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest today is Lolly Winston, author of Good Grief, and she's about to read to us.
Okay, I'll read from the opening. I should say in the book, instead of going through the typical 5 stages of grief, Sophie goes through 15, including denial and anger, but also Oreos and escrow and ashes and lust and waitressing. This is from the beginning, denial. How can I be a widow? Widows wear horn-rimmed glasses and cardigan sweaters that smell like mothballs and have crepe paper skin and names like Gladys or Midge, and meet with their other widow friends once a week to play pinochle? I'm only 36. I just got used to the idea of being married, only got to test drive the words my husband for 3 years, my husband and I, after all that time being single. As we go around the room introducing ourselves at the grief group, my heart drums in my chest. No wonder people fear public speaking more than death or heights or spiders. I rehearse a few lines in my head. I should say, my name is Sophie, and I live in San Jose, and my husband died. No, my name is Sophie, and my husband passed away of Hodgkin's disease, which is a type of cancer young adults get. Oh, but they probably already know that. This group seems up on its diseases. A silver-haired man whose wife also died of cancer says that now when he gets up in the morning, he doesn't have to poach his wife's egg or run her bath, and he doesn't see the point in even getting out of bed. He weeps without making a sound, tears quivering in his eyes. He looks at the floor and needs his sweater in his hands, which are pink and spotted like luncheon meat. We sit in a circle of folding chairs in a conference room at the hospital, everyone sipping coffee out of styrofoam cups and hugging their coats in their laps. Fluorescent lights buzz overhead. They're bright and cruel, exposing the group's despair. The puffy faces circle under the eyes like bruised fruit, dampened spirits that no longer want to sing along with the radio. There should be a rule for grief groups, 40-watt bulbs only.
Thank you so much. That was Lolly Winston reading from Good Grief. There's a lot going on in this book. Another aspect is that you have her becoming a big sister to a girl, to Crystal, who is a cutter.
Right.
Who cuts herself. And that I found that really interesting and wondered how that character entered into the piece.
Well, I wanted Sophie, sort of has a breakdown, leaves town and starts over, and I wanted other characters to enter her life, and I wanted, a happily ever after person for her that wasn't just a new man. And I thought it would be interesting. She and her husband weren't able to have children, so I thought, it would make sense that she would join the Big Sister program. But she sort of hopes for a little girl that she can bake with and color with, and she ends up getting this troubled teenager who is kind of a nightmare and frankly not very nice to Sophie at first, and swears and smokes and starts fires and cuts herself. And I wanted Crystal to be troubled so that Sophie would have to reach out and help her, and there'd be some conflict between them. And so I, sort of researched the various troubles that teens can have. And I didn't want to have an eating disorder because I thought, well, that's been written about quite a lot, and there's already the issues with food for Sophie. And so I read and did a lot of research about cutting, and it just struck me as something that would really, sadden and resonate for Sophie, and something that she could try and help Crystal with.
How much research do you feel is necessary before you start writing, or do you sort of do it in concert with the writing?
I usually do it when I get to the section where I think, I started out as a fiction writer, an English major, and I wrote papers and I wrote fiction. And then after doing corporate stuff, I worked as a freelance writer writing articles. And during that time, I realized, you go out in the field and meet people and describe things. And I thought, gosh, I could do that as a fiction writer, too. I could research and take notes and go places and describe things. And so I incorporated research into the novel where I'd never really done that before in the short stories. And I think it's, that's my question. How do you know when you're done researching? I knew when I was at the Los Gatos Library reading about cutters, and it was a dark December day and raining, as it does in the winter in California, and I thought, I think I have enough information on cutters. I had pages and pages of notes, and it felt like enough. I felt a little overwhelmed, I guess, by the research, and it felt like I needed to be back at the writing.
Mm-hmm. We always talk a bit about the business of writing on this show, and this is your first novel.
That's right.
I imagine that it was easy to sell.
Well,
was it easy to get an agent and sell it?
The first agent that I queried, I was lucky in that I had a very nice teacher who liked the book well enough that he said he would read it when it was finished and then recommend it to his agent. And I was thrilled. That's a huge stroke of luck and really a big favor to do for someone. And he did that, and he recommended the book to his agent, but she turned it down. So I was pretty devastated because I was excited to have this contact, and I had taken some time off from freelancing and run up the visa bill to finish the book. But then I asked the teacher who was helping me, you think I ought to do some rewriting? And he said, no, don't touch it. Just send it out again as it is. And then the second agent, whom I queried, she signed me on. She's wonderful. And I think she sent it to three houses before it was bought by Warner Books.
Mm-hmm. And then it became a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, I mean, that's like winning the lottery. Really, I think that's because Warner chose it as their lead title for spring. And the lead title, I never knew this, but the lead title for each season really gets an extraordinary amount of marketing and publicity. So it really was just like winning the lottery, and I really think that helped bump it onto the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, it's interesting how they do that, how they pick pick books, but never.
Yeah, in a way, I think that the wealth ought to be spread around a bit more, you know, because there's a lot of wonderful books that don't get the attention they deserve, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, the writing here is just really just so good and fun, and the tone, you know, it just carries you on. I was surprised, as I said, with the topic of grief, that it would be a book that I just so wanted to stay with.
Well, those are always my favorite stories, I think, the ones that are dark and funny at the same time,
right?
Like Lolita or The Bell Jar. It's always been my favorite kind of story, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Do you find that you're able to read things like that, things that you like a lot, as you're writing? Are you too influenced, or is it a good thing to be influenced by what you're reading?
Well, you know, I love to read so much that I'm not able to give up reading when I'm writing. I know a lot of writers do. What I do is I'm careful about reading first-person things with very strong voices, anything with a very strong voice that might sort of seep into your subconscious the way a song gets stuck in your head, I guess. But I just finished reading Jonathan Lethem's book, Motherless Brooklyn, and now I'm reading Saturday by Ian McEwan, and I just picked up Nicole Krause's beautiful book, History of Love, and I can't help, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I guess I'd rather, if I could do one or the other, I'd rather read than write.
And, sure.
I can't imagine not reading. So.
Mm. We have a few minutes left with Lolly Winston, author of Good Grief. Let's talk a little bit about the whole process of revision. Do you revise a little bit as you go along, or did you have the entire draft? Did you sort of barrel through the first draft of this book before you went back to it?
I revise quite a bit as I go along. In fact, I think I'm a little too guilty of that. It was one teacher, mentor, friend of mine, Frank Baldwin, who's the author of Bawling a Jack, who, you know, he gave this great piece of advice, which was just finish it, because I was obsessively circling back over the first few chapters. And, of course, in some cases, it could be that you might just dump your first chapter. So there's a lot to be said for just forging ahead and finishing, I think. But I also think it's important to get the voice and the particularly if it's a voice-driven story, just sort of get that voice and tone nailed down in the first chapter. And after doing that, I always rewrote the chapters as I went along, and then I finished, and then I did a rewrite of the entire book. It's hard for me to draw the line, I guess, between writing and rewriting.
Mm-hmm. So was the beginning of the book the beginning?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was always the beginning.
Hmm. Interesting. And you didn't start with a prologue either.
No, although at first the story started a year after Sophie's husband's death, and readers were finding, they thought that that was too far out. For me, I felt like the first anniversary of death is what really triggers the grief, and so it didn't ring true with enough readers, though. So I, even though that might factually be true, I had to change it and make it 3 months. So there were all, you know, altercations. I changed things like that, alterations like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an outline that you followed, or did you just sit down and sort of every day and go, well, where was I yesterday? What needs to happen today?
What I did was I started writing, and I wrote my way into the first section, and then I did make an outline, and I found sort of an outline and then sort of a to-do list where I could have each chapter and add, you know, put ideas for what might happen in that chapter or things to fix or consistencies to carry through. And it was hard because I'd always written short stories or essays or feature stories, and you can hold, you know, the template for something that short in your head and sort of imagine the whole thing. But a novel is so big and unwieldy that it's more overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, isn't it?
I'm always interested to know how other novelists work and if they use outlines.
And it does seem to me that I hear more male authors talk about using outlines and these extensive plots than I hear women.
Oh, that's interesting.
Talk about them. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's just the ones I talk to, or if we can generalize and say men are more comfortable with outlines. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I know. We need a research study.
That's right. We need a federal grant. But I guess for me, to get character and voice, and then you ask yourself, well, where is the story going? And it helps to sort of sketch it out, I think. You know, I think when I was in an MFA program, we didn't really talk about structure and plot, and as though we really talked more about the writing, which is good, but I realize now as a novelist, having finished a novel, that Aristotle talked about structure and plot, and, you know, if it was good enough for him, maybe it's okay to sit down and, you know, draw a triangle and sketch out some plot ideas.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, well, we're at the end of our time. I know you have to take off, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Well, I really think the best advice has to do with what Frank told me, which is just finish it and really just sort of show up and do the work. You know, Woody Allen said 90% or 80% of life is just showing up, and I think that's true with writing more than anything. It's so hard. A lot of times writing isn't fun for me. You know, it's solitary, it's hard work, you feel like your brain might start to bleed, you know, it doesn't pay anything, but I think it's, you just have to show up and sort of chip away at it on a regular basis.
Sure. Yes, it's sometimes hard to stay in the chair. We talk about that a lot.
That's, you know, right. I heard that John Irving had a seatbelt in his chair.
You're kidding.
Well, I've read that somewhere, and I can see, you know, yeah. I mean, you find yourself staring into the refrigerator, and you don't even know how you got there.
Well, I think we need I always talk about this in my classes and when I give talks, because I hope that there's an inventor in the group, but I really think we need a seatbelt with an actual sort of, you know, way to latch it, and then you have to set a timer and it won't open until the time goes off.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe it has an emergency release and then it sounds like a fire alarm so that you really don't want to use that unless there is an emergency. Yeah, some way to keep it.
That you say timer, because I have a fellow writer friend and she sets an egg timer and works in 45-minute blocks.
Uh-huh.
She found an article that said this is the best way for PhD students to finish something as large as a thesis, and
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to take like a 10-minute, 15-minute break and do something else.
Yeah.
And I actually do that on a lot of days, just think of it in 45-minute blocks. And obviously, for a lot of people, that's going to be all the time you have that day for writing.
Right.
But I think just dipping into it a little bit is okay.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much
thank you.
For coming on the show and continued good luck on this book, and we look forward to your next one.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for supporting us authors.
Oh, sure. That was Lolly Winston, author of Good Grief, published by Warner. The show's only a half hour today. I'm going to put on some music and tell you as well, don't forget the West Hollywood Book Fair this weekend, Sunday, at San Vicente Park in West Hollywood, if you're in the Los Angeles area. Lots of wonderful panels, an all-day affair. You can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on appearances. You'll see that I'm going to be there, and there is a link to the West Hollywood Book Fair website where you can read about all the panels and authors and agents and everybody who's going to be there. If you're there, come say hi. And otherwise, I'm going to leave you now with a quote by John Updike, who said, "Writing and rewriting are a constant search for what one is saying." Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.